Well, there I was in the courtroom, sitting with the judge up front. As a youth pastor in Detroit, one of my students had felony charges against him. And I was brought in as a character witness. I didn't say anything, but I remember the picture. I will probably never forget the picture of the courtroom. The justice and the lack of justice that I saw. This particular student had actually committed a crime at youth group. And it wasn't his first crime at youth group either. He didn't like me, and he threatened me and my family. And yet here I was as a character witness to help him. And I remember as the judge questioned him directly and asked him what happened, what he did. And I remember him shading the truth. You know what that is? That's lying. To try to get these felony charges dismissed or lowered to a misdemeanor. And I kept thinking to myself, does this judge know that this 18-year-old is lying through his teeth? Does he know that? And I thought, I bet this judge has seen enough guys like him. He knows. You know, he knows this guy's not telling the truth. But still, he lowered the charges and he left the courtroom with a misdemeanor instead of a felony as an 18-year-old. I was happy for him. I was thankful despite the rocky relationship that I had with him. I didn't think it would be good for him to start out his life as an 18-year-old with felony charges. But it made me think this. He was a very proud young man. And I was a target to him to kind of show how big he was and how strong he was and what a threat he was. So I remember walking out from youth group, locking up the church building, high school youth group night. Everybody's gone. I'm walking to my car with my wife. It's not a rainy night, anything like that. And he and his buddy drive up in their car and do circles around me and my wife, just wanting me to feel like, hey, I have power over you, Gabe. And that was pretty much his persona. But as he stood before that judge, I saw this young man humbled. He realized, even the man he was lying to, the man in front of him, the Detroit Circuit judge, had the power to send him to prison, to stamp a felony on him, which would alter his life. And I remember seeing him quiver and shake, which he never did before me. He never had that kind of fear. Well, this morning, we're going to talk about judgment in two different ways, and it can have two very different influences on us. The first kind of judgment we're going to talk about is when we're judged by others. In fact, you've heard the word judgmental, right? And Christians can often be accused of being judgmental. They are overly judgmental. And we've got to own that as something that we need to grow in as Christians and know that as we live on mission. That as we talk about Jesus, sometimes that's the first thought that comes to people's minds. You just got all sorts of judgment for my life, right? That's what they're thinking. And you'd say, no, not at all. I don't think that about you. I love you. I care about you. And yet they want to stamp you as judgmental, right? That's the first kind of judgment we're going to talk about. How we can tend to judge, have an opinion about someone, and that can be a problem. In fact, that's a problem we face. The second kind of judgment we're going to talk about is God's true and right judgment, which is the answer in Psalm 26. So here's the problem, though. The problem with judgment, I want to flip the perspective. But you need to know that, Christian, that we can come across as judgmental for a number of different reasons. Some of them right, some of them wrong. But we also can be caught in the crosshairs of judgment ourselves. Have you ever been the brunt of neighborhood gossip? Have you ever picked up an unwanted reputation Maybe at work, you work hard, but someone thinks you're lazy because you like to work this way or do that. Or maybe you've wound up on the bad side of a really vocal or a really powerful group of people. You know, as I think about the elections that are over a year away, and yet we get to watch some political figures who've already walked through the nightmares of a public relations horror and being on the bad side of the media. And we see this all the time, but we can also be in the crosshairs. In Psalm 26, that's what's going on in our psalmist's life. We don't know what it is, what slander, what gossip, but here's the question. What hope do you and I have when we are pierced by the disapproval of others? What hope do we have? What can we turn to? Well, look at our Psalm 26. David is given credit for this, and we can safely assume that this probably speaks of an experience that he's walked through, but it's one that many people can relate to. In verse 1, he says this. He says, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted, O Lord, without wavering." Verse 1 right here tells us so much. You see, this word vindicate literally means, "God, judge me." The most literal translation of the Hebrew here is judge me, which puts us in a courtroom setting. Or in Israel, it was when the elders gathered together at the front gate of Jerusalem and they would decide things, and criminals would be brought, people who had done things, broken God's law, and they would be tried right then and there. We don't know what it is. It could be that. Maybe he's accused of something publicly. Or maybe it's just the community gossip. Or maybe there's someone who's vying for his throne or power, and so they're slandering him and accusing of things that might be true or they might not be true at all. But right here, we hear the desperate cry in verse 1, "Vindicate me, vindicate me. God, you judge me." Sometimes we feel hopeless. We feel like there's no solution when we're on the bad side of someone. But the psalmist cries out to God. This is what we need to see right here. Who does he turn to when he feels like someone is wrongly judging him? It's God. He turns to God and says, "Vindicate me." Now, there are these three main verdicts that God could give or that we see in a courtroom. And the first is this. It's a no judgment. There's not enough evidence to give a judgment. An accusation has been made, but the charges aren't substantial enough. There's not enough evidence to determine either way. Then there's a second outcome. It could be you're guilty, right? Someone accused you of this, and they prove that you're guilty of it. That's not what the psalmist is asking for, though, right? He's saying right here, "God, declare me innocent." That's what he means when he says, "God, judge me. I want you to look at my life, and I want you to say the gossip is untrue. The accusations are false. I want to be cleared of all guilt and exonerated." Oh, what relief is this psalmist crying for? Vindicate me. Now, our psalmist gives two reasons in verse 1 that kind of give us an overview of Psalm 26, and it's this. He says, "I've walked in integrity. I've walked in integrity." And secondly, he says, "I've trusted in the Lord." Now, here's what he means when he says, "I walked in integrity." He's not saying I'm perfect. He's not even saying that there aren't some things that I should be accused of. What he's saying is this, that I am a follower of you and I am devoted to you. And we're going to find that throughout the psalm. He's not saying he's perfect. In fact, I'm going to go ahead. I want to skip down to verse 11 because here's a second imperative or plea that he gives. He says, "As for me, I shall walk in my integrity." And he says this to God, "Redeem me and be gracious to me." So if we think Psalm 26 is just about David saying, "Hey, God, I've got an argument with so-and-so, and you need to be on my side, God, and not on their side," that's not what he's saying right here. He's saying, I need your grace. I need your redemption. I need you to restore me, make me whole, sanctify me, make me more like your character and less like my character that's sin-filled. So when he says, I've walked with integrity, he's saying, I'm devoted to you, God. I am committed to being a follower of you. That's who I am. That's what I want to be. But I'm being accused of something differently. And then secondly, he's trusted in the Lord. Trusted in the Lord. And those imperatives in verse 11 tell us what he's trusting, that God would be gracious to him. He's not saying, I'm perfect, but he does have a fear of the Lord, that he follows the Lord, and he needs his mercy. Now, this is probably most important for us to see in verse 1. Instead of David getting caught up in trying to prove himself to his peers, which is what I'm going to say, that's what we want to do. That's what I want to do, right? Don't we want to be exonerated? Don't we want to get credit for the good things that we've done? Yeah, we don't want people to look at those other parts of our life. You know, I'm working on that, so I don't want people to look at that under construction part of my life. But we want to prove ourselves to other people. But David says, no, God, I just want to be proved to you. He approaches God. You know, Christian, in the world of opinions and rulings and verdicts, we need to look to God and trust that his ultimate judgment matters. It carries eternal weight and authority. His authority to judge us and to literally say, you are this or you aren't this, is supreme. His authority is supreme. Think about this. In the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court could pick up any case that's going on or working its way up in the lower courts, and it could give a judgment one way or another, either affirming the judgment of the lower courts, or it can overrule it. And I want you to put yourself in the shoes of that judge that maybe had many sleepless nights while he had to decide this case or that case. And he went one way. He thought this was best. This was what the law said should happen. And yet it makes its way up to the Supreme Court, and they say, nuh-uh, we decide this. And they change it. You know, how would you feel about that? But why can they do that? Because the Supreme Court has ultimate authority over all the other courts' decisions. In fact, our lower courts look to the Supreme Court's decision to decide things, to rule things. They don't just look at the law, the legislation. They also look at what's already been decided. But how much greater is God's authority? That we look to him as the ultimate authority to decide what's right or wrong, what's good and what's evil. And that's what our psalmist does right here. I want you to note this posture. He doesn't turn to defend himself. He turns to his God. He turns to Yahweh and says, I want you to judge me. He's opening himself up to the judgment of God. That's what we see in verses 2-7. We see submission to God's examination. Submission to God's examination in verses 2-7. He is willing. He not only knows that God discerns everything, what's pure truth and what's someone trying to slanting the truth, there's no secret hidden from him. There's no lasting deception. You know, God's not the judge that hears a bunch of baloney from an 18-year-old and buys it. No, he doesn't do that. He knows everything. He knows when we're not telling the truth. He knows when we've put on a mask or a front. If we think that we can hide something from God, even our motivations and our desires, we are wrong. But this is the second part of this humble posture of David. He's opening himself up and submitting himself to God's examination. Look at verse 2. He says, prove me, O Lord, and try me. Test my heart and my mind. For your steadfast love is before my eyes, and I will walk in your faithfulness. Now, the heart and the mind are things unseen to us. I mean, I really wish sometimes I could read people's minds. Like, I've got a 2-year-old that talks and she knows she can talk and she's so confident, but I can't understand her most of the time. If I could read her mind, that would be great. When I was getting ready to go out on a date with my wife this week, and she asked me the question, "Are you gonna?" I'd been working on a few projects, and she said, "Are you gonna take a shower before we leave?" And I wish I could have read her mind, but I kind of got a hint, right? You're like, you're not asking me a question; you're actually making a statement. Like, you need to clean up. You should probably shave before I'm gonna go out and be seen with you in public. Right, we can't read minds and we don't see into hearts. We don't see people's motives, right? Which here's the caution, here's the wisdom of just applying that truth alone, that we shouldn't assume that we know what people's motives are. We shouldn't assume the worst because we don't see people's minds in their hearts. But right here he says, God, I want you to prove me. I want you to look at me. I want you to examine me, my heart and my mind. You know my motives. You know what's going on in here. You know my pride. You know my thoughts. 1 Samuel 16:7 says this, man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. He knows what's going on inside of us. Now, here's my question at this point in the psalm. How can our psalmist be so confident to say, God, I'm opening myself up to you. Just examine me. Wow. Okay, so he already knows this, that God sees what's going on, but he's opening himself up. He's submitting. He's willingly doing this. Why would he do that? Well, it's the next verse. Verse 3 says, my eyes are fixated on your enduring love, your love that doesn't dry up, it doesn't give up, that you care for me, that you love me, even though you do know me, warts and all, right? That's the most beautiful picture of the covenantal love that God intended for marriage, right? Not that you're marrying the perfect person, but you're marrying a sinner, right? And you're going to get to know their warts living with them. It's the same with our friends, right? The love of friendship, that you get to know someone instead of being driven away by where they need to grow, you lean in to where they need to grow. And you want to be their support. God's enduring love. And then secondly, he's saying, my path is founded on your persevering character. I walk in your faithfulness. I know that you will be faithful to me. I know that your promises will always be true of me. What you've said of me, that God is true of himself, that he doesn't change characters, that he's the same. And so he can be confident, I know what you desire, and I am walking in that. And I know you don't change what you want. I don't think he's in the room. Kyle Riggins gave me, we had this great, oh, there he is. Yes. Sorry, man, I missed you. He was sharing about his school year and how it's going. And this is great. I asked his permission to share this, so he knows. He said he had to change his persona in the first few days of school. Because kids came into school and he's known as the relaxed, laid back, I'll respect you as an adult high school students. I'll do that. And that's how he leads his classroom, but it changed this year, right? They really just, oh man, they took advantage. And so Kyle said, I had to change my persona. I had to change my classroom discipline to do that. And sometimes we need to do that. But right here, he's saying, my confidence in you, God, is that you are the same. You don't change. And sometimes we do. I experienced that as a parent, course correcting. Wow, what's my tendency? I was too harsh. Wow, I was talking to my son, some discipline, and I need to actually come to him and say, I'm sorry, bud, forgive me. I was too harsh, buddy. You know, I need that course correction. I need that change. And he's saying, God, you don't change at all. And now I am fixated on you. We become what we behold. Greg Beale is a theologian, and he says this. He says, God has made humans to reflect him, but if they do not commit themselves to him, they will not reflect him, but something else. We either reflect the Creator or something else in creation. And what our psalmist is saying is, I'm fixated on you. I've chosen who I want to be like. I've chosen the character that I want to see in my life. And it's you, God. That's what he says right here. And so he's not saying I'm perfect, but he's saying, God, you know my commitment. I'm committed to you. And he meditates on God in the way that God is shaping his life. Now, here's the contrast. We get the contrast in verses 4-5. It's this. I do not sit with men of falsehood, nor do I consort with hypocrites. I hate the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked. All right, this verse might be one reason why it could be easy to dismiss a Christian as judgmental. Because we are called to be discerning. But what is this verse about? Does it have to be with who your neighbor is? What neighborhood you live in? Does this have to do with what school your kids go to? Does this have to do with who your friends are? No, there's a question right here. The psalmist is stating, I'm not letting these people in my community influence and lead my life. God, I'm fixated on you. And I know that there are people that want to pull me away from you, that deny you, that ignore you. As Pastor Adam said, that don't give you the credit that you deserve. Thank you as creator. And he's saying, I don't listen to them. I don't let them influence me. He's not saying you should have fewer and fewer non-Christians. It's the question of who influences you. Who are you devoted to and committed to? I'm committed to my neighbors that aren't Christians. I love them. I want to spend time with them. But I also want to be careful who influences me and what things I'll be a part of and what I'll take part with them in. And here's the question for us is, do we hate sin and evil for what it is? Could we agree with this psalmist to say, man, I detest some things that go on in my community. I think they're heinous. They're evil. Why? Because God tells me they are, and I'm committed to his way. So then it brings up the question, but whose presence is the psalmist around? And this is the highlight of the psalm. Whose presence is the psalmist around? We're brought to this scene in verse 6. The Israelite worshiper, maybe David himself, walking to the temple to worship and serve God. Where does he want to be? Whose presence influences and shapes him? It's God. Verse 6, I wash my hands in innocence and go around your altar, O Lord, proclaiming thanksgiving aloud and telling all your wondrous deeds. This psalm right here actually offers a picture to us of how did the Israelites worship God? What did they do? Psalmist says that he arrives, and we can assume this is a pilgrimage. Israelites would come from all over the territory to Jerusalem, to the temple. And they would offer sacrifices typically once a year there if they didn't live there. And they would bask in the closeness that they had with God, that his temple represented God's presence. And they come in, and he says, I wash my hands in innocence, saying, God, I've kept a clear conscience. I'm asking for forgiveness. I'm not, once again, not perfect. But he's saying, clean, innocent hands. I'm committed. I'm devoted to you. God, I'm not going to approach you and not be devoted to you and not be experiencing you. I'm here to worship you, is what the psalmist is saying as he approaches God. And so he walks around the altar, and what does he do? He praises God for the latest truth that he learned in a theology book. No, he doesn't do that. He's thought about what God has done for him over the past year. And here he is to offer sacrifices in Jerusalem. And he's saying, God, I thank you and I praise you for that harvest. And thank you for that child or that grandchild or what you did in our community. I praise you, God, for how you've been good to me. It's recounting what God has done and their experience of him over the entire last year. He's declaring every good thing has come from you, and I'm here. I've come to your altar to praise you for it. You deserve the credit for it. Just like as God is our judge, he decides what's good and right. And so the psalmist with confidence looks at his life and says, I have things to praise God for because I know that these good things have come from God himself. Which leads us to this, the pure conscience that this pilgrim has leads him to a joyful experience of being near God. Now listen to this, verses 8 through 11. Standing in the presence of Yahweh. Oh Lord, I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. See, this is what's incredible. This psalmist has just openly confessed that God is his judge. That God is the one who stands over his life and says, this is right and this is wrong. Yahweh is his ultimate job, his judge. And he's right here in God's presence. And you'd think it'd be fear and trembling. You'd think he'd want to run away. He wouldn't want to have his devotions that morning because he's afraid that God would find some sin in him. But right here he says, no, I want to be closer to you. I love your presence. There's no hesitation. And then he returns back to judgment. Verse 9, he says this, do not sweep away my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloodthirsty men. Verse 10, in whose hands are evil devices, and whose right hands are full of bribes. You see, the psalmist right here is absolutely confident that God will come and judge everyone that has ever lived on this earth. But he's confident that he's going to escape that. He's confident of God's grace. Look at verse 11 again. But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. The plea, redeem me and be gracious to me. You know what this psalmist knows? As he approaches God, he's not going to deny that God judges sin. He's not going to deny that. He actually embraces it and confesses it. You know, that today we want to dismiss that God would have anything to say about our life, how we do things. We want to dismiss that, right? But he doesn't. He embraces that as he walks into God's presence. And yet he confidently asks, God, be gracious to me. But he knows this, and this is the main point of the psalm. God doesn't play games. God doesn't look at the personas. He doesn't look at the character that we try to put on the surface of our lives and show other people around us. God sees right through to the heart. God is the ultimate judge. He has both the authority as our creator to judge us, but he also has the clear discernment of what is going on in our hearts. So what response? If God's our ultimate judge, but he's a gracious judge, what should our response be? And the psalmist gives it to us. I am committed to walk in my integrity. And what he means by that is, God, I am devoted to you. I'm not confident to walk before you in your presence because I'm perfect, because I'm not. I'm confident because of your grace. J.I. Packer says that a lot of times we think our life is about proving ourselves to God so that he would love us, so that he'd be faithful to us, he'd extend his relationship to us. But he says, no. We don't try to prove ourselves. That's a self-righteousness. But he does say that our lives are the index of our heart. You look at our actions. You look at our words. You look at God's transformation in your life, and here's what you can see. You can see who you're devoted to. Are you living in such a way that you've received God's approval? Or are you living in such a way that you're trying to earn other people's approval? Our psalmist is trying to do this. He's saying, God, I want you to examine my life because I have tried my best to display the grace that you've given me and the expectation that you will continue to be gracious to me. And so he ends with this, the expectation of the final verdict in verse 12. My foot stands on level ground. My foot stands on level ground. In the assembly in the great assembly, I will bless the Lord. What he's saying right here is, I am utterly confident to be standing in the presence of God, and yet I know he is the ultimate judge. That is amazing. That is incredible. That God would powerfully execute justice and judgment, and yet this guy says, I love being in your presence. That's a question for us. But here's the truth. We escape God's judgment through judgment. Because here's his grace defined. Here's his grace revealed. It's this, that God would send his son and lay the judgment that you and I, church, deserve on his very own son. We escape judgment through judgment. That judgment has been paid, that you and I can say, by God's grace, I stand on level ground. Because God wants you confident in his relationship with you. He also wants you confident in looking to him. When you find yourself, you're reading the neighborhood gossip, right? You've picked up that newspaper. I don't know how you get it, but the neighborhood gossip, and you're in there. That you and I wouldn't say, I want to prove myself, or I've got to do something about this, or you're so concerned, or what your boss thinks about you. Because here's the truth. In eternity, it really doesn't matter what the neighborhood gossip says about you. In eternity, it doesn't really matter what your boss's review of you is. You ought to live in devotion to one person and one person alone, just like David here, devoted to the God who is also gracious to him, that sees him and knows him. Do you know how much freedom there is in that? To be known by someone, warts and all, and yet to hear them say, I love you. That is spectacular. Here's my encouragement to you. Let's not defend ourselves. Let's actually embrace things. We ought to be able to handle other people's criticism much better than most. Because as Christians, we're confessing, those people don't know my heart. They don't know the ugliness right here. And yet I've been forgiven all of it. We ought to be able to embrace it. Let me pray that for us. Jesus, would you help us to see that you have shouldered the ultimate judgment, that our judge, you, will say, here's my righteousness. I've taken the judgment for your sin on me, and that we can be freed. God, I pray that you would give us a confidence in you, that God, when we think about how we work, we're working to please you. When we think about how we love and serve our families and friends, that God, we would do it as to please you first and foremost, for your approval, because your grace is working in us. And God, I pray, Lord, that you would help us right now to look at our hearts, that they'd be an index or a review for us to see, are we truly devoted to you? And God, when we see that by grace through faith, I pray that you would help us to have utter confidence, like the author of Psalm 26, utter confidence in your presence, that we would have no fear where we failed, but our eyes would be fixated on your steadfast love. It's in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen.